I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Royal Automobile Club talk show in association with Motorsport. I'm Ed Foster, and I'm joined by Motorsport's editor, Nick Trott. Thank you very much for joining us. And the great Dario Franchitti. Thank you so much for joining us today. Now, we've got loads to talk about. We've got lots of readers' questions. But most importantly, it is Nick's birthday. So thank you so much for joining us on your birthday. I'm sure you have far better things to do, but you're here. And I would sing you happy birthday, but my voice is terrible. So someone else can do that.
Oh, this is a great way to spend my birthday, actually. Yeah. I'm very happy about it.
Very kind.
Thank you.
We haven't started yet. You don't know what I'm going to be asking you. Now, as I must also say that this is my last talk show for the club and the last podcast for Motorsport. I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank you all for listening. We started them back in 2009, and the first one we got 600 listeners. Despite that, we've ploughed on, and now we get about 100,000 of you tuning in every month. So thank you. Without you, these wouldn't have happened. Thank you also to Alan, who has been recording these almost from the start. But he's been much more than that. He's been a great friend, a great mentor, and everything I've got right is because of him. And the amount that he's edited out that was terrible, you would be astonished about. So thank you, Alan. Thank you also to our guests who turn up a month in, month out, don't ask for anything in return, and give us amazing content. So thank you.
We're not getting anything.
I think Nick's agreed to give you quite a big check for this one, but anyway, I won't be here.
Cup of tea and a chocolate biscuit.
Not my budget. Thank you to the guests. It's been an honour and a privilege to be a part of these. And what better way to finish than with Dario? So thank you for joining us today.
And we should thank you as well, Ed. I think you've set the standard actually for these podcasts. It's interesting.
A very
to
low
see.
One.
No, pat yourself on the back. You have done a really good job, and it's interesting to see some other racing titles have put a lot of effort into their podcasts recently, and I think that's because of the standard that you've set. So you reintroduced me to motorsport as well, actually, via the podcast. So I think, right. And I know speaking to readers, you've done that. So, we'll miss you, and you've done a great job, but onwards and upwards, eh? Yeah.
Indeed. Well, I'm sure everyone will see me sort of around and about at Goodwood doing various bits and pieces. But let's get started with the podcast. That's what we're here for. We're not here to sort of tap ourselves on the back too much. Dario, last time I saw you, we were at the Motorsport Hall of Fame down at Woodcote Park, the club's based down there, and you were driving a McLaren M6 up the captain's drive, which for anyone who sort of hasn't seen it, it's about 4 foot wide, quite old tarmac, and you had cold tyres. How was it?
It was amazing, first of all. It was absolutely brilliant. And the good news was the guys from Hall & Hall had really pumped the tyres up, and they told me they'd pumped the tyres up. They said, "You're not going to go quick around a corner, are you?" I said, "No, I'm just going to try and do a burnout. Is that okay?" They kind of all went, "Oh, yeah, absolutely." And the driveway was just slightly wider than the M6. So when I got it a little bit of angle, it was pretty close at both ends, and it was wonderful. It was a great evening. But the highlight for me was definitely driving the McLaren M6 and seeing Freddie Spencer in a dinner suit on a two-stroke Grand Prix bike.
Yeah, it was amazing. When he arrived, he brought all his stuff in this massive bag that sort of dwarfed him. And he said, "Is it all right? I'm not going to try his accent." But he was like, "Is it okay just to do it in my jacket and tie?" And I was like, "If anyone can handle it, it's probably Freddie Spencer." So it was good to see him.
Very cool. Very cool.
In his sort of helmet colours, but then dinner jacket. Excellent.
As somebody said, if James Bond did MotoGP...
Yeah.
Yeah, so true.
He wore his gloves there as well. Did you know he had helmet gloves? Yeah. But that's what they say, isn't it? If nothing else, helmet gloves.
Yeah,
you know?
I should mention Andrew Frankel actually, who the year before drove up the captain's drive in his dinner jacket, but with race boots on.
Which that's what Andrew wears.
Yeah,
that's what he wears all the
seen
time.
It before or since.
It's quite a combination, really.
Yeah. Right. So we should get going, but the. Big news, obviously, Fernando Alonso Indy, and you wrote a great piece for the Motorsport website before he went, just after the news was announced, and you said he's not going to struggle with speed, but it's going to be the racing and the traffic. How did you think he did?
Brilliantly in the race as well. I mean, his qualifying performance was very good. I wasn't that surprised with that. What he did in the race, the way he adapted to oval racing and adapted to the constantly moving environment, because it all depends on a place like Indianapolis in a race where people position their cars relative to yours, and you've got to move that around. And he just, you could tell he studied a lot before he even got in it. And the first practice race runs they did as a group, because groups tend to form in practice even, and just watching the way he worked through the groups and watching his learning process, he's obviously very, very smart, but he was a student of the whole thing. And he gave Gilles de Ferne a lot of credit. You know, he said qualifying, he said, was, you know, I felt that was me just getting right on the limit. And Gilles, he said, but Gilles really taught me what to do. I listened to him. And then Gilles said to me later on, he said, you've got no idea how good this boy is. I said, yeah, I think I have. And he said, but no, he said, he's an exceptional talent. And he was right in there. He was right in that sort of fight. Obviously, the cars were very good. The Andretti cars were fast. But he did a very, very strong job. And not only in the car, I was as impressed with what he did out of the car. His attitude, because obviously an open paddock, an IndyCar, you can be walking along as a fan and, you know, Alonso will walk straight past you. There's the car. So the access is a lot different than F1. And he handled it brilliantly. And when he got out of the car, when the engine had its problem, the cheer that went up, I think, said it all.
And he didn't get spooked either by the accident, you know, Bourdais' accident, which was, you know, frightening for us all to watch. A driver of Sebastian's experience and speed on ovals, for him to hit the wall that hard, it didn't, I don't know whether it affected him or not, but he didn't lose any speed, did he, Fernando, from that?
He's obviously very mentally strong. I mean, obviously, what he's gone through the past couple of years, he's built up a tolerance. But there's one thing building up a tolerance to a bad result. It's another thing building up a tolerance to what he witnessed. And we're talking on Sunday night about Dixon's accident, and he said, I saw an engine and a gearbox. He said, I'm wondering, where's the rest of it? And then he got right back after it. And that takes a certain mental toughness to do that. And he had it. It would be great to have him back in IndyCar, or, you know, in the Indianapolis 500 again, if that's what he wants to do. But just watching what he did in Canada, he looks like a different person, doesn't he?
Would you say it was a flawless performance? I mean, everybody has been singing Fernando's praises, but, you know, I know it's mean to be critical, but are there any areas where you think, do you know what, just a tweak there, maybe next time?
Well, of course, but every driver does that. No driver does a flawless race. No, they don't. And he obviously, if he does it again, I think he will come back stronger. Whether the car will be as good relative to the rest of the field is another question, and that's obviously one of the things you have to deal with as a driver. But yeah, there was nothing you saw and thought, oh, he really messed that up, or he really messed that up. You know, pit stops were, again, this is all alien to him, the way it all works. Nailed that. The start must have been a little dicey for him. He lost some places, but he got back up to the front, got back up to the sharp end, and raced everybody with a lot of respect.
I think that was one of the things that struck me, was the amount of respect he had for the race. Because you were mentioning his preparation, he obviously watched thousands of hours on YouTube, on boards, everything like that. But he also would do hours in the simulator before practice or something, and then go to the track. And his preparation, he obviously was soaking it all up. And I think as a two-time Formula One world champion, and people always telling you, oh, you're arguably the greatest driver in Formula One at the moment, and people telling you that all the time, to go to the Indy 500 and actually respect it, says a lot about him.
Yeah, he went there with his eyes wide open, realized it was going to be a challenge. And you know, anybody that's worked with him is, they've all said that to me. Yeah, this guy's a worker. He's got a lot of talent, but he works. And you can tell that he's got this relentless energy about him, and he just wants to keep improving. And all he's interested in is racing cars, it looks like. All he wants to do. But again, it's that word respect. He had a respect for the race, for the drivers he was competing against. He wasn't sort of, he was very respectful of them, and them of him too. It wasn't a case of, they all wanted to beat him, absolutely, but they wanted to beat everybody. But they you could tell there was this sort of camaraderie went on between them, and it was the fact that he'd come over to do it and became, you know, one of the, I was going to say the boys, but obviously, you know, we had some girls in the race too, and, you know, whether it was in the bus lot, it all worked, and it was great. And I will say it wouldn't probably have happened in the Ron era. And you've got to take your hat off to to Zach Brown for having the sort of the vision and the balls basically to go to the bosses upstairs and say, this is what we want to do. And they were there. Mansour was walking down pit lane during qualifying, and I saw Indy Lal race weekend. So the whole team was getting into it.
Now, sort of since the race, I think Hamilton made some comments about the fact that, oh, well, if you can qualify fifth against people who do it all the time, then that says a bit about the drivers. And then there's been this sort of slight spat between IndyCar drivers and Hamilton. What's going on there? Is it just a bit of ignorance? Or,
you know, I was asked this question the other night at the dinner, at the Hall of Fame dinner. And I sort of said, you know, well, did Lewis actually make those comments? Well, he hasn't sort of come back and said, no, I didn't make them. It is that lack of respect. He has no idea what he's talking about. And at the time, he just qualified the Mercedes 14th at Monaco.
It
wasn't great timing. And Lewis is obviously a very, very capable driver. Being a great driver is one thing, but it just was kind of classless comment. And to make that comment with no knowledge of what it's going on. You know, I don't have a knowledge of what it's like to only have to go out and race one person. You know,
and come second.
Exactly. He doesn't know what it's like to race against these guys in Indianapolis 500. Fernando Alonso does. He can comment on it and say, "Wow, those guys were good," or "They were better than I thought," or, you know what, they weren't that good. He can make that comment now because he's done it. And you know, Lewis sometimes does that though. Everybody's got their flaws, and Lewis occasionally sounds off about stuff he really doesn't know about.
Yeah, it was. If he said it wasn't very stylish, and actually not very stylish for him either, because he does respect the history of racing. You know, it's clear he does. But I don't know. That slipped through the net, I think, that one. So the only thing I can think of that he should do is give it a go.
Yeah, exactly. And he might have been having a bad day too. And trust me, we've all said bad things. But yeah, if you feel that way, have a go. Because actually, maybe not in his world, but in my world, that's the prize money is a fair chunk of change. So if it's that easy, come along and have a go.
I mentioned before, we got loads of readers' questions. I've got pages and pages of them here. And I was going to come to them in a second. Well, I got one here from Glenn Alcock. Just relating to this, and he said, Darry, if you could have had a one-off appearance in the Monaco Grand Prix in a front-running car with practice time, would you have missed the Indy 500 for it?
Glenn's a good man, actually. He was at the 500 last year. He's a good supporter of actually the young Scottish guys coming up, the young Scottish drivers. Would I have done that? With hindsight, I might have given 06 a skip because the car was never competitive from start to finish. I mean, I always put it this way. From 07, every time I sat in the car, maybe not so much the last year, we weren't really competitive, but 7, 9, 10, 11, 12, we were in with a shout every time I showed up at Indianapolis. I wouldn't have given up any of those chances. Again, with hindsight, 06 was a bit crap. I might have said, okay. But the 500 meant a massive amount to me, and that was the path my life went was over to America and IndyCar. If you'd asked me that question when I was 17, it would have been a much different answer.
Yeah. And we shouldn't really talk about the Indy 500 without mentioning Taku. You know, I can't think of a more decent guy. I've never met him, but from what everyone tells me who knows him, he's just such a lovely guy. And for him to get that win was quite special, I thought.
Taku's a funny one because he's such a lovely guy, and then you put him in the car and he's an absolute monster to the point of being sometimes just mad, and he goes for gaps that aren't there. And you know, on Saturday night he cut across the grass and took Dixon out. I've been taken out by him before the restart, before the flag was waved, he speared into me. We had obviously the coming together in 12, and my last crash was off the back of his car because his suspension broke. But as AJ Foyt pointed out to me, he whacked it off the wall, broke suspension, and when I tried to pass him, he hit the overtake, which caused the problem, ultimately accident. But the other side of him is he's a really lovely guy out of the car, and he did a flawless job at Indianapolis in that race. He did a really really nice job. There was times he sort of half made a move. I thought, oh, here we go. And he backed out of it and used his head. And then, you know, as I say, sometimes he tends to make those crazy moves. Sort of saying is no attack, no chance. Yeah. And sometimes there's a bit too much attack and it diminishes the chance.
Yeah. There's a sort of slightly related to this. We got a question from Anthony Jenkins. He says, Paul Tracy seems, on the strength of his television commentary role, to have mellowed. He's loose and witty. I never saw him as such in his racing days when he was your teammate. How was he then, and how do you find him now?
VT's always been witty. He's always been the fun guy. And when I first came over, before I was his teammate, he was one of the guys that straight away was nice to me. You know, the more experienced guys tend to give the rookies a wide berth and just sort of, you know, until they've sort of paid their dues or whatever. PT was straight up, hey man, what's going on? And we remained friends throughout every one of those times we came together as teammates and everything. And he was always funny. With his commentary role, I think he's relaxed into it to the point he is. He's very astute and he's good value. At the Phoenix race, I stayed with him. My buddy Albert and I stayed at the PT's ranch or whatever it is, and it was hilarious. And Townsend Bell was staying there too, and we were just laughing at Paul constantly because he's entertainment and he was a brilliant driver who sometimes was his own worst enemy, but that's why people loved him.
He had a chance in a Benetton, is that right?
In
F1.
Tested at Estoril.
Yeah. Do you see why? I mean, having, you know, raced him, do you see why he got that test? Do you think he had the pace to deliver in Formula 1?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. Especially in those early years. I mean, when we became teammates, it was sort of 98 was our first season, and I think he went through a... He wasn't maybe as sharp as he had been those early years. Then he went back and won the Champ Car Championship in 03. But he was, he maybe just wasn't as sharp back then. Yeah. He had pace to spare. And I will say that with Paul, even in those days when he wasn't quite over a lap as quick as I managed, you know, I would start in the pole or whatever. 20 laps into the race, you look in the mirror and here he is, and you just think, oh god, because you knew if there was a chance to pass, he would do it. And even if sometimes if there wasn't a chance to pass, he'd have a go. Nothing but love for PT.
Talking about commentary roles, how are you defining Formula E and your role there, because you've literally just come back from Berlin for the E-Prix. How are you finding it, because it is a lot of our listeners and readers think it's interesting, think it's something different, and a future of motorsport, not the future. And then a lot of listeners and readers hate it, I think is probably the plot. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely Marmite with I think, you know, people who are traditionalists, some people think, oh, that's quite interesting. Others are, they don't like it. I agree with you. I think it's a very well put, it's a future of motor racing. Is it going to replace F1? Is it going to replace IndyCar, all those things? No, but electrification is a big part of what we're going to see on the roads, and going back to sort of the 60s, 70s, and before that, the race cars of today being the street cars of tomorrow. So there's a lot of development going on there, and the manufacturers love it because they can do that. They can put their money behind it, and they can sort of get a return on that investment. Plus, it's good racing, good teams, good drivers. It's good racing. Is it perfect yet? No, but it's constantly evolving, and the guys that are running it, Alejandro and those guys, have kind of caught in a bit of a tough spot because the manufacturers are like, well, we want to develop battery technology and we want to update our motors all the time, etc., etc. Then you get into sort of a cost war, whereas they're saying, whoa, hang on, calm down, we're going to have a one battery for all, we're going to have a spec part because we need to control that. Otherwise, can you imagine the costs of the increase of costs in the battery technology? And for an example, one thing they've done well, they've said, look, this isn't an aerodynamic formula. It's fixed aero. There is no aero, basically. You see people bash a wing off and it still goes as fast. It's mega. The tires are, you know, it was a Michelin tire. It works in the wet and the dry. They get two sets for the day. Everything happens on one day. They get two sets for the day, one for each car. And I think they should keep that and not sort of start working with the chassis and all that, just have one chassis. It's a powertrain formula, and you don't need to be sort of chasing F1, and I think they've got quite a clear sort of vision on that as well.
I'm kind of the other way. I'd like to see a freedom in battery, the development of battery tech, because at this point in the next 3 to 4 years or so is the crucial point for electrification of road cars. And we haven't been able to genuinely say that there's a road to race transfer in motorsport for quite a long time. And I think we could if there was the freedom in battery tech. Now, I know the costs would go out of control, but manufacturers will spend whatever money they want to spend.
That, you know. I think, though, that is the problem, is simply the cost of it. You have the have and have nots, but that's part of life, isn't it? That's obviously the speed of the cars is going to go up, and that's one of the areas that they struggle with a little bit right now, because the technology that was available 3 years ago, 2 years ago, is much different than what we've got available today.
I just mentioned the sort of one set of tyres. Well, we limit ourselves to one set of tyres when we go off with historic Dunlops to some of the race meetings we're doing this year.
We can't talk about that. We embarrassed ourselves the last time out. I think we'll avoid that. I need to ask about the you've driven the Formula E car.
Yes.
Do you think the performance of the Formula E car as it evolves could take it away from some of the city street circuits and onto the Imolas and some of those circuits?
I hope not. I hope it doesn't. I want to see more. I want to see them give them more power.
Yeah.
There's two different sort of ways of looking at it. There's a new battery coming next year. It's going to be more dense. It's they're going to have more usable energy. So you're going to use that to go longer, or use that to turn the dial up. Yeah. I want to see them turn the dial up.
Absolutely.
Because when you put them to 200 kilowatts in qualifying trim, they look quite good. They slide around. You can hear the height, the pitch changes in the engine. Yeah. Keep cranking up. Because they already they're catching a load of slides. There's no grip. There's more power than grip in a lot of situations. That's fun. And
grip.
More power than grip is, and that's the way I would like to see it go. Because obviously with an electric motor, the torque just ramps up from zero straight away. Yeah. And that the acceleration of them is really something. But part of the great thing of Formula E is they get to race in places that, if we had internal combustion engines, unfortunately, we just nowadays are not going to get to some of these venues.
Yeah. It was Tony Brooks, wasn't it, that said a racing car should always have more power than its chassis can handle. Which I think is a nice way. Now, someone mentioned in the office, apparently you're fronting a campaign to educate drivers on the dangers of concussion at the moment.
I wouldn't say fronting it. Because of my unfortunate experience with concussions, you know, we did something in America with the Road Racing Drivers Club, the RRDC, which Bobby Rahal and his team have really re-energized over there. You know, guys like Mark Donohue and those guys did it in the 60s and 70s, but Bobby sort of started it again, and they have a sort of a free tuition series online called Safe is Fast. And one of the things we talked about with Steve Ovey, who has been my brain doctor for 20 years now, pretty close, and he was the CART brain doctor for a long time. So him and I did a sort of a tutorial on that and what to look for and everything. And then the guys in the FIA now have started sort of talking about it a bit as well. Just giving experience on what to look for, because it's something that, if you're driving an Indy car, a Formula One car, WEC, okay, you have an accident. Especially in IndyCar, you have an accident. They basically look, and you've got accelerometers in your earpieces, and it says you hit your head so hard. Okay, let's do a concussion test with you. If you guys are racing this weekend and you crash the car, God forbid, you say, "Oh, I don't feel very good," but you're not going to have a doctor saying you've hit your head at X G's. You should go and get checked. So it's just to sort of encourage people to what signs to look for and what to do.
Yeah, Dario and I talked about this a couple of years or so ago when I bashed my head. And it didn't cross my mind that I had a form of concussion until we actually spoke, you know, because I was quite happy that I didn't really seem to have any after effects around that time. But then, you know, over the months passed, and Dario said, "You probably had a concussion," you know, and it's wow, we don't really know enough, do we, about it? You know, we know when we've got a sore knee, or we know.
Exactly. And in the US, because they've had the problem with the NFL with the footballers and concussion and the long-term effects of that, they're learning every week. They're learning more and more and more, because these players and the players' families are now saying, "Oh, well, there's lawsuits flying around," so they need to figure out, which is great for everybody else, that they figure out, you know, as much as they can about what's going on.
Because rugby's very he's much better on it now. 2 years ago, it just wasn't taken seriously enough.
Yeah.
And in a car, you're in a sort of a moving missile at 200 miles an hour. So the dangers are almost more acute than, I mean, to be fair, some of those guys probably weigh more than a car, but
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, John
James
Beattie
Haskell,
and I, yeah,
so it springs to mind.
John Beattie and I talked about it up in Scotland. He came and did an interview with me at the house, and we talked about concussions because him being an ex-rugby player, John's had a few fair hits to the melon as well.
Right, I should ask some of these questions because we have got loads, and if we're going to try and get through most of them, I know it's, you know, being your birthday, you probably want to get off and go and eat birthday cake.
Honestly, this is a cool birthday.
So I've got one from Jamie Smith here asking about your memories of winning at Rockingham. How did it rank alongside the many other wins, and what did you think of the circuit?
It's a bit mean to ask him about his memory after we talked about concussion.
So I could have phrased that. Jamie, you should have phrased that
Rockingham.
Better.
Rockingham. Hang on. Now, Rockingham was, to win there was timely, because I'd signed up to do what was then the IRL, which was an all-oval series, and I'd never won on an oval, so thank God I did that. To win in front of the home crowd was really special. I think I'm right in saying we were almost flat out around that little oval towards the end of the race, yeah.
Seriously?
It was absolute, wow. With the speedway wings on those things, yeah. It was mental. The speeds were out of control. It was something... something to behold. I think I had unusually for Bridgestone and Firestone at the time, I had a tire issue. I thought I had a wheel bearing failure, and I had a tire issue. We pitted off sequence and got to the front, and off we went. Wasn't a great track for passing, but that was fine. When I was in the lead, I was quite happy. But to win in front, both my grandmothers were there, which was cool. My family, a lot of my extended family was there, and again, to win at home is always special, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I flat out around there. It's for when you go there as a kind of a British fan, and I've only ever been to a couple of ovals in America, it does look huge. I mean, it is massive, but it's tiny compared to some of the other ones.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you get the right foot peeling off the throttle and your brain's going, what on earth are you doing? Right foot, go back down again.
We call it driver flat. we being the guys on the timing stand now, and I'm, you know, my job at Ganassi is working with the team and the drivers and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, occasionally we'll be, Max will come in and go, yeah, I was flat here. No, you weren't. Yes, it was. Yeah. No, you weren't. Yeah, there's times that self-preservation does take over. We had a situation, 2009, 2010, we raced at Loudon, New Hampshire, which is a mile oval. It's completely flat. Well, completely flat. They say there's some banking, but it feels completely flat. And it's basically two hairpins, long straights with tight hairpins. And we were able to go flat out in practice. And I then convinced my engineer that if he trimmed it out, I asked the question, I said, if you trim this out and I can get up to the same, if I can get up to a higher speed, then will I have the same downforce that I had before? And he said, yeah, but you can't lift, because as soon as you go slower, you'll be... So I managed to convince myself to bury it for two laps, and it's maybe the craziest thing I've ever done. We got pole position, but there was that thing of, I am not lifting, and so you end up trying to push the throttle right through the bulkhead, because it's the only way you know you're not going to lift.
That's just extraordinary. The fact also that it was calculated. I know we like to think, oh, that's just balls out, whatever, but you'd worked out that the higher speed, more downforce, I couldn't do this.
And I trusted my engineer. Yeah. I think he's as mad as I am. Probably more so.
We've got a question here from P Dizzle 99. I don't think that's his real name. Dario, can you please give us a good Greg Moore story that most people don't know?
Most of the Greg stories I can't tell you. A Greg story that most people don't know. I don't know if they know the bus trip story. So we 98, mid Ohio 98. So we were Greg, Max, myself. Greg's like, right, we're going to take my bus, because we all had motorhomes at the track. It was, you know, 48-foot buses or whatever. We'll drive my bus from Mid-Ohio to Road America to the next race. So Max and I, yeah, mega. None of us had driven the bus before. So we'd swapped shifts. We'd drive along with it. and one would literally, as we were driving, one would walk out, the other would walk into the driver's seat. My stint was through the middle of Chicago. But as it was going on, as this trip was going on, I was renegotiating my deal with Barry. Greg was trying to get out of his player's contract to go somewhere else, which we later found out was Penske, and Max was trying to negotiate with Bobby Rahal. So we'd be driving along, and if you were in the driver's seat, it'd be like, foam a drink. Yeah, hang on. Can you take the wheel? Get out. And they would go back to the bedroom in the bus, close the door, and they'd have their, we'd all have our negotiations and come back to, you all right? Oh, yeah, good. Who was that? It's my mum. And it was so funny because we're obviously great pals, but we were, you know, we're rivals too. As it happened, Greg had to wait a year and obviously tragically didn't get to drive that Penske. Max got his Rahal deal and I got my pay rise from Barry.
and at the time, everyone just thought they got on with their mums really well.
Exactly. Yeah. You're very respectful to your mum.
So nice that you have that relationship. Ed Berg's asked quite a lot of questions. And there's one here that I quite like. You was wondering sort of what would you say your driving style was most like? And he's put brackets, hint, Rick Mears.
I'd love to be compared to Rick Mears. I think in IndyCar, Rick Mears is known as the Rocket. And Rick, while he was smooth and incredibly intelligent, still is. I spent a day with him and I learned all this stuff. I thought, crikey, could you not have worked with me? I might have won some more races when I did stupid stuff. But Rick really loved an oversteery car and could handle it. I was, up until late in my career, I didn't like that. And I managed to develop a style to on the oval to drive an oversteery car. I don't know who I would compare it to. Jackie taught me a lot. I'm not saying I'm anywhere nearly as good as Jackie Stewart, but Jackie taught me a lot, that sort of smoothness. You know, some guys were always on edge. For me, on a road course or a street course, if you watched the in-car, I think it was very difficult to tell whether I was on a warm-up lap or a pole position lap because I did put very minimal inputs into the wheel and I braked softly and all those things. So I think I had quite a smooth, relaxed style. On the oval, again, smooth, but I developed a technique and I've developed a style where I could handle a car that was oversteering.
It's interesting. I mean, obviously, your brother Marino is a hugely accomplished driver as well. Would you say there's a kind of a similarity in your styles? Is there like a genetic similarity in the way that you guys drive?
Yes, there is. I think your driving style comes from what you grew up driving. So the way my dad set up a kart when I was 10, I think really that set the tone. And I had to, if I was going to change that style, I had to consciously change it. Yeah, Marino and I's style, bizarrely, and our feedback is very, very similar. We were at Daytona and we'd never driven together. And we went out and we blatted around. And we came in and the guy's like, oh my God, it's identical. The way you approach a corner, the way you brake, the way you release the brake, everything about your throttle inputs, they're identical. I said, this is bizarre. And my mum has often said, and my sister Carla, that we share a brain cell. So it's possible. it possibly might be, it might be true.
Yeah.
On the Marino subject, we did, I don't know if I told this last podcast, we did Petit Le Mans, and we were teammates there, and I'd by that point won a few Indy car championships and a couple of 500s, and Marino was going very well in the sports car, won Petit a bunch, so it's like, okay, this is great being your teammate, but I want to be quicker than you. And he was quicker than me on one lap, on multiple laps, especially through traffic, he was quicker, but they gave me some new tires. I thought, right, I'm going to show you. So I went off, warmed the tires up, went hauling down into turn one at Road Atlanta, which in that P2 car was a brush of the brake, down one, hard on it. Well, it's got a dip in the middle of the corner, and as it's compressed, it snapped into the biggest oversteer, and I've all arms and elbows, and I managed to somehow, through pure luck, not crash, and it's gone down the grass. Come in, I'm like, yep, coming in. So I come in, and they've had live camera back to the pit. And as I come down the pit, Marino is leaning over the wall, applauding.
Thanks, bro.
Thanks, Marino. Yeah.
Brilliant. So you were sort of talking about an oversteery car there and things, which I just find it sort of a weird thing, doing, you know, 200 miles an hour and dealing with oversteer.
Yeah, it's 240 when it's oversteer. Yeah, it's really.
So there's a question here from Rafael Perez Diaz. And he heard you once mentioning doing a four-wheel drift in a champ car at Indy being the only way to be really fast back then. How on earth was that even possible? I second that. And why wasn't this part of the conversation on the sort of specialised media and things? Because he didn't hear it mentioned anywhere else or see any of it.
Well, why wasn't it part of the conversation? Because at that time, you don't want anybody to know what you're doing. Basically, the only person that knew what I was doing was Scott Dixon, because he was doing exactly the same thing. And it was the sort of the last generation Indy car, actually, as opposed to the champ car, because they had less horsepower in the champ car. So you ended up setting them up much more aggressively and really in yaw a lot of the time. So you'd come up to turn one at Indy, and if the wind was in the wrong direction, which it generally happens to be, for turn one, you would have to back it in. And as you would basically... Imagine you're going down the straight, you're turning right the whole time because of the stagger and the tires and the offset of the suspension, but the offset of the setup. The car wants to turn left, so you're turning right to keep it in a straight line, and your wheel is offset as well, so it sits like that from the straight ahead. So you've got about, I had quite a number I liked, so say it was about 20 or 30 degrees of lock to keep it in a straight line, and then you start to turn in, and as you would turn in, just you almost release the wheel and the back would just start to come round, and you just catch it all the way in until it compressed into the banking, and then it would build up. It would be neutral, and then occasionally you'd have a little understeer towards the exit. So you had to have it dancing on the way in to avoid a death plow understeer on the way out. And it, I think in 2010, the car was massively fast, but it did it every bloody lap. Every lap, 200 laps, and 2012 wasn't a lot better, but that was a DW12 car, and it didn't slide as nicely. Had a load of weight in the back, and it would sort of snatch as it slid. So you'd have more snaps of oversteer as opposed to a nice consistent slide. Yeah. When I think about it now, it's absolute madness, but it felt totally normal to do it at that point.
We've spoken before about when the speeds have. Have gone really crazy, especially on the short ovals. Do you ever felt like you got to a point where your reactions and reflexes weren't quick enough for the speeds? You know, if the car was gone, it was gone. You couldn't do anything about it.
The champ cars were like that. You had to catch them on the first snap, and it was almost a, how do I describe it? It wasn't a snap. It was a, you'd get this sensation, and you know what I'm talking about when you're...
Oh, yeah.
But what,
yeah.
What I mean by that,
number
guys,
of Indy 500 wins are...
So you're driving along, and you get that feeling of, oh, it's just about to oversteer. Yeah. Well, it's much more subtle, but you just, oh, and you just, something in your senses, and you're tuned into it, is, oh. And as soon as that happens, you better catch it the first, because if it went the second time, it was going to be big. Yeah. So that's, yeah, that so was...
You kind of develop a sixth sense for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of...
Yeah, you do, and you've got to be so tuned into what's going on. The only time I actually felt that I have no control here at all was Texas, that when everybody was starting to black out and they cancelled the race, and I was hanging on to this thing. I think 235 miles an hour average, or 237 around Texas, and I was not in control. I was just sitting there piloting it, and yeah, that was the one time I thought, this is bloody madness.
Yeah. So a question here from Carl, who's just very complimentary, saying your driving talent propelled you to great and well-deserved success.
Thank you.
He admires the patience you showed Paul Tracy. But now that you've retired, did you ever, as he suspects, develop a technique to gently nudge other drivers who encroached by getting too close into or through a corner? The thought first occurred to him at Long Beach in 2012 when rookie... Newgarden challenged into the first corner and ended harmlessly in the tyre barrier.
Yeah, that was all actually my friend Albert talked about. It's his fault because he proposed to his now wife Hillary on the grid right behind me. I was about to step in the car and somebody sort of tapped me on the shoulder, and my guys knew that if I was stepping in the car, just make sure nobody annoys me. And I turn around and there's Albert, And he goes, watch this. And I thought, oh, what's he going to do? And then he got on his knee. I thought, shit, he's fallen over. Sorry, maybe not supposed to swear. And he proposed to her. And Ganassi's going, what is going on? Anyway, first corner. Joseph's got quite a high regard for his ability. And I was on new tyres. He was on used tyres. And he thought he was going to go around the outside. So I wasn't going to allow that to happen. Or I wasn't going to try and let that not happen. But I think with having seen video and how many years later, I just... My front wing, it was the DW12, and I think it was the first sort of year of the DW12. And any car I'd raced before, this sounds like a bunch of driver excuses, but every car I'd raced before didn't have the wheel guards at the back. And literally, if you look at it, my wing just taps his wheel guard, and it was definitely not on purpose. And he went in the wall there. But I'd been used to sort of judging the distance with no wheel guards, and I tapped in there. I wish I was that good that I could have done it on purpose, but that was
that's a yes, I think, to Carl's question.
No, it wasn't on purpose, but it did happen.
It's brilliant. I love the wheel guard excuse. We're gonna have to wheel that one.
I'm gonna remember that one.
Put that in the book.
I asked one of Ed Bogue's questions earlier, but it sort of relates to what we were just talking about. Was using mind games a tool that you used against opponents in racing? It seemed you always got on, you always got in Willpower's head to the point he was his own worst enemy.
I didn't intentionally do it. The difference, you know, Will and I have actually become good pals, and we talk a lot about racing, why we do it, and all these kind of deep conversations now that we have. And if people from who watched us in you know 10, 11, and 12 would go, what, you two? But we kind of lived that together, and because of that there's kind of a brotherhood and there's a lot of respect there between the two of us, and I like the guy, but at the time I would never let people see me bleed. I'd never let people know if I was having a bad day. My job was to kind of whatever was going on, deal with it, but never show it to the outside world, where Will and still does, his emotions are on his sleeve. And so I just took advantage of that. And, you know, by that point, I'd won a couple of championships anyway. So I was quite relaxed about what I was doing and how I was doing it and knew what I had to do. And so, and Will was, still hadn't done it, didn't know how to do it. And, you know, was sort of, he was still clawing to understand how to do it. So I took advantage of it a bit. We laugh about it now. At least I laugh about it now. The fact that, you know, he won a championship after I retired, which I like to remind him of. But I think he just, at the weekend he won in Texas, and I think that equaled Paul Tracy and I on the wins list. So he's had a hell of a career so far, and I think he'll keep going. But
this what point in your sort of racing education did you decide that you weren't going to show how you were feeling? Or again, is this your character, or is this something that
I know exactly the answer to that. And I had a call from him last night. I hadn't spoken to him in a long time. Tony Mattis was the trainer at Mercedes. Mm-hmm. And Tony worked on the mind, the body, everything. And every time I went and damaged myself in America, the first thing I'd do is jump on a plane to Zurich and head to his place in Feldkirch in Austria, and he'd sort of put me back together with Doc Holvey, Doc Trammell. And he called me last night and just said, hey, I saw you on, you must have seen it on TV from Formula E. And he was the guy that taught me, I think he taught me mental strength, and he taught anything I had in that regard, he taught me how to get to it, and how to get to it, and how to get to it consistently, and how to sort of control your emotions, how to focus. And Jackie always talked about mind management, but Tony really taught me how. I'll always be grateful to him for that. And it was, you know, I got beaten up in Formula 3. Jan was my teammate. Jan did a great job. Went to DTM. I listened to Tony. He taught me how to do it. Then I got to return the favor to Jan in DTM. But that was because of that. And I up until the last time I drove an Indy car, I was still using what he taught me. And I like to try and help the guys I'm working with today with that same advice.
How much time, you're talking about the guys that you're helping, how much time do you spend on the sort of the mental side? And because it's obviously such a big part of racing, but it's very hard to quantify.
It depends on the driver. You know, with the four drivers, with each one needs a little something different. Dixon's very mentally strong. So Dixon and I just kind of, we more chat about, we have these conversations to get his mind working about what's going on with the car and stuff. And just like we used to do when I was driving, but obviously I'm not driving now. So it's not a case of a Scott, you need to do this. Or have you thought? It's like, hey, have you thought about that? Just to try and be an extra teammate for him, really. You know, Tony gets very emotional. So with Tony, it's more keeping him calm. Charlie, it's just sometimes getting the focus there. And then with Max, Max has shown incredible mental toughness this year because he had a really bad test at the start of the season and everybody was worried. And then he went and led 50 laps at Indianapolis. It was like, yeah, okay, attaboy. And he's just shown a toughness there. And, you know, with Max, it depends day to day what he needs. But it was a lot of times trying to access that inner hunger, and he, bloody hell, he's found it, I'll tell you. And it's great to see.
Well, what do you think of Max as a driver? Because he'd obviously, you don't win a GP2 race without being a fairly talented driver. He's struggling in Formula 1, but he was in the back of the grid team.
And consider the car.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I think there were quite a few people who were saying, look, he's here as a paid driver and that's it, which I think was perhaps a little bit unfair. But he has, as you mentioned, he's kind of blossomed now. And is that, did he always have that, or has something changed dramatically?
He's always had the talent to drive a car, no doubt. He's always had that talent, and certainly since he got an Indy car. But as I say, that inner fire I've seen past couple of races, it's like, okay, right, this is good. If we can keep this going, keep that fire burning, and you know, with his talent level, okay, now we're making progress. You know, his feedback still needs work. He's kind of inexperienced with that, but he's working hard at it. So what he did at Indy was really good to see. And the fact that he was mad that he didn't win it, I was like, yeah, all right. It wasn't like, oh, high five, you know, that was great. It was like, we had a bit of a sort of, well done, mate. You know, he had, with his family, who are massive supporters of him. It's so cool to see that. But then he was like, right, onward.
Are there any drivers who have slipped through the net in recent years in terms of getting to IndyCar? I mean, there's been some strong drivers in Indy Lights. Dean Stoneman did really well. Is there anyone that you've seen or you'd have thought, God, I wish they'd made it into the big series?
Well, I think time's still on his side, but Felix Rosenqvist, obviously, is in Formula E, doing a brilliant job there. I mean, he's a special talent. He's driven a lot of different cars. He's a guy I look at and think, yeah, you know, his F1 thing didn't happen, but I think he's a big talent and a smart driver too.
We've actually got some road car questions here. There's one from, again, I don't think this is his real name, Mr. Abel Old Git. So he's asking about your three favourite road cars. And we've got a question from Stuart Gallagher, who's fellow journo.
Stuart.
What's the best road car?
Is it a clean question?
Is it? Yeah,
Stuart's done all right there. Thanks, Stuart.
But what's the best road car he's owned and driven? And of course, the worst he's driven and owned. So sort of two similar questions there. I'll bolt them together.
Okay, three best. I mean, Nick knows my taste in cars, I think, as well as anybody. Three that I've owned or three that I would want to own?
Let's go the latter, because it frees it up a bit.
Want to own. My Carrera GT, I love it. I think it's the... It does everything for me. The thing is, three cars is tough. Because I could endlessly collect cars. You know, people say, oh, you know.
What do you mean, could?
fair point. It is a weak spot. The Carrera GT, I'd like Daytona Spider with suitable modifications. You can play around with them a little bit. Joe McCarry's done that with his one. It's pretty sweet. And I don't know. He's got the Carrera GT in there. It's
not
so
just
tough.
Any Carrera GT though, is it? I mean, I believe that if you listen out at certain times, you can hear his Carrera GT start up. Pretty much wherever you are in Europe, you can hear this thing start up.
What have you done to it? Just
took the silencers off of it. Because it's got this, the Carrera GT's got this massive silencer box that weighs, I don't know, 70 pounds that sits behind the rear axle, right at the back of the car. And the Carrera GT's known for being a little tail happy. And it sounds amazing as standard. And I thought, well, if that's good, then more of that's going to be even better. So we found this exhaust where they put some, all it's got is two little resonators and no silencing at all. So £70 gone from the back of the car. And it sounds like a V10 F1 car.
Amazing.
It's a business.
Says the man who commentates on Formula E. Yeah.
And I'm going, I'm going back to Scotland this week and I'm going to get it out and I'm going to make some music. It's so much fun. But on the other side of things, I got a new NSX that I smoke around London you put it in quiet mode and it's in hybrid most of the time. It's like you run around in electric motors, and as a Scotsman, you'll appreciate this, the fuel gauge doesn't go down. It's mega.
That is quite good, actually. I like that.
I have a number of stories that I could share from a car of the year that we did a few years back when I was with Evo. Stuart Gallagher was on it as well. I'll save some of it, but there's one memory that I'll never forget. As we were driving along this same bit of road doing some photography, and Dario was there, Marino was there. We had a Camaro, was it a Z28?
The Camaro, the one that, the crazy one. Yep.
The crazy Camaro, which the front tyres were 305. So we're doing photography, you know, trying to be grown up and sensible and everything like that. And then Dario disappears off with Marino. I go off in something else, hot hatch or something, go up the road, go over a crest, coming in the opposite direction. Dario and Marino. And these two looked like schoolboys, just absolutely laughing their heads off as this thing was kind of just slightly above the surface of the ground.
It was a very aggressive bump.
It was a very bumpy road, I have to say. Yeah, but I nearly went off the road laughing at these two coming the other way.
That was hilarious. Fun, wasn't it? Yeah. We were serious journalists, though. We were having a very serious time. And
it was all for the benefits of the Car of the Year test.
North Coast 500.
North Coast 500. Absolutely, yeah. What a road!
Got to get back up there this year. Yeah.
I still haven't done that, which is what I think I've driven all the roads separately, but just never done it all in a one.
Stunning, yeah. Stunning, good. Yeah.
Wonderful, yeah.
So I'm just going to turn to the world of sports cars, because I also haven't talked about it too much. Tom Allum here is asking, how close did you get to driving at Le Mans? And then below that, someone commented saying, Porsche 919 2014.
2015, I think it would have been.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. it was... There was no contract signed, but I'd gone to Vysak in 13, early 13 actually. I'd gone there because I got to go to Vysak.
And don't need an excuse.
Exactly. So I went and was chatting with Wolfgang Hatz, who'd become a friend, and Andreas and the guys running the teams there. And it was they didn't even have the simulator up and running. They had an LMP2 car in the corner that they were starting to test parts on. It was very early days, and Weber and I had talked about it quite a lot, sort of saying, oh, would you fancy doing that? Oh yeah, I'd love to do it. Yeah, okay, well let's, and we sort of, I guess, made it happen. And it looked, I wanted one more year to do another go at Indy in 14, and they wanted some time to sort of work out what their programs were going to be. But we said, right, 15, we'll let's work towards that, let's get it done. And unfortunately the crash happened, and that was it. But to race at Le Mans would have been fabulous. I mean, yeah, I look back and I think of all the cool things I got to do, more than I ever thought I would. But to race at Le Mans would have been something special. Went there last year, watching Marino and Dixon and those guys. Been there a number of times now, and it was just a great race. And in my opinion, this is my opinion, people say, oh, it's up there with Indy 500 in terms of how cool it is.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's the atmosphere at Le Mans. I can't speak for Indy because I've
got to come over.
Yeah, it's on the bucket list.
We just need to go.
But Le Mans is special, because it's kind it's so much more than the race. It's great.
You know, and that's one of the things when I look back and I think of, you know, two two wee boys in Scotland. We, because he's just short. We, because I was younger than him, was McNish and I. And we sit and to think that we, you know, I was fortunate enough to win 3 500s. He won 3 Le Mans, 24 hours. And you think and look back and go, how lucky were we to get to do that? And it's that those are the fun sort of things to when you get to reminisce about stuff like that.
Talking about sort of reminiscing and fun things like that, have you got a book coming out? Because there's quite a few questions here talking about when it's coming out. There's one from BD Phillips, and they're asking sort of how the book is coming on, but also where you're up to in your back editions of Motorsport magazine. I think you've got the full compliment, haven't you?
I haven't got the full compliment yet.
Your poor wife. House is filled with it.
Yeah, I'm in the process of building a new garage just now, and there'll be lots of space. Nick Mason's my hero in so many ways, but he has got the full complement of motorsports, autosports. God, he pretty much everything.
Does he?
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. The book, to be honest, we just got too busy with different things. So at some point we need to revisit it and see. We might do it for one of the anniversaries of something. I don't know. That would be 2000, maybe 2022, the 10th anniversary of the last Indy win or something. I don't know. We'll see, but I'm still working on collecting my missing years of motorsport. The early years are still missing. There's some in the 80s, I think. So I'll get on eBay when I've got time and I'll fix it.
I've got everything back to 50, but not
everything.
Yeah,
that's cool.
And actually, my wife amazingly said yes to having them all up in the house. It was the first box that I unpacked. She was like, "Was that coincidence or is that you being a total bleep bleep?" And I was like, it's the latter.
You're quite newly married though, aren't you?
Yeah,
right. So let me just give you a little bit of advice here. If she said okay to that, something's coming from her side. Okay, there'll be an expectation, you know,
right, okay,
a little bit further down the line.
Okay, excellent.
So just
thanks
be careful
for the sage advice.
Yeah, no worries.
Anyway, we are slowly running out of time, and we got I'm not sure this is his real name, Silverstone Lewis. So he's saying he loves when you're on the podcast, always fascinating. He's talking about the synchronicity of many things that have to happen in order to win a race. Can you talk about one of your favourite wins when that synchronicity was very apparent, when everything just clicked and you felt the energy and see with your car, your crew, the race and everything like that?
This is kind of a sick one, be honest. And the reason it's popped in straight into my head is that we were in Detroit. We were pitted next to Marco Andretti in his pit, and Miller, the guy I'm going to mention, works on Marco's car. Miller worked for Greg as well, so I've known Mike for a long time. And I think it was Pike's Peak 2004 or 5. Anyway, I came in for a pit stop, and I think I was leading. I came in for a pit stop, and I went in a little too hot, and I hit him, and I broke his leg. And he got up, he fueled the car, lost hardly any time, fueled the car, then proceeded to sort of pull the fuel probe, which weighs a ton, pulled the fuel probe, sat down in the pit wall as if nothing had happened. We went out, and he turned to one of the mechanics and said, "Can you get me out of here, please?" He said, "Because I think I've broken my leg, and if the officials see that, we'll get a penalty." And so they kind of carted him off, and there was no penalty, and we won the race. And that just, to me, there's so many things go into a race of, you know, all the teamwork, all building the car, building the engines, all these millions of things. But that shows that there's a million moving parts, and it's about the people who you're in the trenches with that make it happen.
So I think it's a sort of final question. We can't do a podcast with you without mentioning Jim Clark. And this one's quite a nice one, because obviously next year is quite a big anniversary. What would be the perfect day to commemorate Jim Clark? What would you want? What would you look for?
Perfect Jim Clark day would be probably be in Scotland, get up in the morning, jump in the Cortina, blat it down to Dunn's, have a wee walk around the soon to be newly expanded Jim Clark Museum. If you haven't donated yet, please do so. We're looking for funds to expand it. It's going to be mega. And then go to Churnside, pay my respects, and probably head off to somewhere like Oldham Park and take the... Andy Middlehurst has got the 43 with the H16 in it, and he's done such a beautiful job with that. Have that there, maybe the one of the 25s, and of course the 49, which is in the country right now.
Is it?
It's in the country, it's in the UK. And take some laps around Oldham, I think, or down to Goodwood and do the exact same thing there and just and then have a meal with a bunch of his, you know, his friends, and obviously I have JYS there, Bob Dance, those type of guys, and just have a few drinks and tell some stories.
Sounds like a great day.
I think we've just nailed your next year's cover for you, Nick.
I think we have.
Yeah. There we go. Yeah.
Well, that'll be a great tribute. Yeah. Wonderful tribute.
Yeah, that'll be amazing.
Yeah.
Nick, thank you so much for joining us on your birthday. Dario, thank you so much for being here for the last podcast and so much insight. It's been great, as always.
Can I just say thank you? No, the videos have been so much fun, and you've put your heart and soul into this, and it's been to listen to them, never mind being in them, to listen to them and from different parts of the world on flights and everything, the entertainment for a race fan like me and somebody that loves the history. Thank you. They've been cool.
Thank you very much. That's very kind. Thank you to Alan, who's been here sort of pretty much from the start after our sort of disastrous attempt at recording these ourselves.
Alan
stepped in and turned them into something much better than they deserve to be. I won't see you next month. All these guys will. There'll be a new presenter who'll probably be a lot better than me. I won't. So good morning, good afternoon, and good night. Bye-bye.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.